debris on the ground covering these filbert worms. That is an infected filbert worm larva. Quite handsome. So let's start with the bioassay in 2006. As you can see here, they did a nematode rate of 57 infective juveniles, and they used 5 larvae per cup, 8 replicates per nematode species, and again, 3 nematode species, and when I show you the results, you'll see the 3. And they incubated them at 22 degrees C. This is really an ideal situation for these nematodes, and they looked at these larvae and looked at the mortality after 10 days. And here's your results. As you can see here, remember now, 57 IJs, they had 100% infection with Steinernema and heterobaptitis. Again, this is a lab situation. But they did a 25% less, really, for the Steinernema crazii, and 0 in the control, nothing. So it was quite promising. They say, okay, next year let's do some more. And here they said, let's choose Steinernema only here in the lab, looking at 5 larvae per cup, 4 replicates, 22 degrees, and look at it after 14 days. And again, I told you they were looking at with hypernaculum and without. And you can see here they found no difference, very promising, that whether it was in a hypernaculum or not, they had 94% control. And you see they also used 2 different rates. That first bioassay was at 57, but they used a lower rate and a higher rate. And they did have less infection at that lower rate, but not bad, greater than, you know, you can see 79 to 89%. Let's go to the field. That's Denny Brook, by the way, who's in the other room. He would have been good to do this talk. Harvest occurs right around October, November. Temperatures are lower. You know, they thought, well, how is that going to affect the nematodes? The soil is moist. It does rain there in Oregon, if you've heard that, it's true. But the orchard floor is somewhat clean, but after harvest you start seeing a lot more debris coming down, so it really depends on your timing. So they did a field trial in 2006 using 10 larvae in 6-inch long pots that were pushed into the ground about 3 inches. Again, 10 larvae were put into each one of those tubes at a very high rate. He said, let's go optimum, like just really saturate these guys, 200 infective juveniles. And they looked at the infection after 24 days. They had great infection with Steinernema. They had 90% out there, which to me somewhat makes sense. But heterobaptitis, only 20. They weren't sure why. They thought, well, let's do it again next year. But let's just use Steinernema this time. And they looked at, let's look at bare soil, and let's look at substrate and apply it at very high levels of water, gallons per acre and low, from 80 to 200. And they took these, instead of the tube, they used gauze bags, and they had 10 cocooned in each bag. The results? Terrible infection. 11 to 12 under a bare soil, and debris 6 to 5, really no difference in the nematode rate. Couldn't figure it out, and they still don't know. They said, were the temperatures too low? I looked it up, 10 to 12 degrees centigrade. Remember in office, in lab, 22 degrees centigrade. Was the rate too low? Was that 200 just, you know, way too high? Exposure time too short? Could there be another nematode that had better searching capabilities and not such an ambush nematode, or, you know, what happened? They really don't know. And so, I talked about most of those conclusions. I'm going to go to the next one. Their future research, looking, is there another suitable nematode? Is there timing off? Should we use it maybe in the spring when the temperature's warmer? Let's identify some of the infestation sources. And when they collect the nuts, a lot of those larvae are falling right below those containers there. Why not, you know, sanitation and use nematodes on that? So there's a lot to be learned, and you will see another study next year. We like to acknowledge all our grant agencies, the people who have helped out, laboratories. Thank you.
As most of you probably know, I'm involved with the Survey of California's Beetles, a massive project trying to document as much species diversity within the state as I can. And Tenebrionids are a big part of this. As you know, Western North America is really a big region for this group, and they're very poorly known still, so there's a lot of problems to work out. So this is really something that I've had to try to come to terms with over the last couple years, just figuring out what species are here and learning how to identify them. So it was a good opportunity for me to kind of get up to speed on a difficult group. There are some other appropriate things. We're very near the home of Frank Blaisdell, who's one of the great Tenebrionid specialists. Did a lot of work on San Diego County Tenebrionids as well as things throughout North America. And many of you probably don't know that I was a graduate student of John Doyen's, and I was in fact his last graduate student before he retired. I was really acutely aware that he had never really had a Tenebrionid specialist come out of his lab. And there was a little bit of pressure early on to maybe do something in that realm, but not a lot. John was, you know, a very accommodating guy. But I left there feeling kind of guilty, and maybe this is some kind of a small atonement for not having gone in that direction. So I don't know. If any of you see John, please tell him that I gave this talk, and maybe he'll feel like, you know, his efforts weren't completely wasted. So for this talk, really my main goal is to try to teach you all, the specialists, something about Tenebrionids that you don't already know. I'm going to go into some details on phylogeographic work that we've been doing on a couple of species in California. And after that obligatory rigor, I'm going to go on to more of a taxonomic overview of California's Tenebrionids. And I was basically ordered by our organizers to show you a lot of nice pictures. So we have that as well. So I'm going to start by describing our area of interest right now. I'm currently funded to work on diversity within the transverse ranges primarily. And this is an east-west running range in Southern California, area of real high topographic diversity, environmental diversity. Out here on the eastern end of these mountains, you're really getting into desert. So this is all Mojave Desert here, Colorado Desert coming up from the southeast. And you see a lot of those elements sort of starting to penetrate into the transverse ranges there. As you come towards the west, obviously there are a lot of coastal habitats at the lower elevations. And in the northwestern regions, you're really seeing the southernmost extent of a lot of cool, moist forest influence from the north. So we have things like madrone here, which is really kind of a more typical north coastal tree. And it wasn't too many thousands of years ago that we had redwoods growing along this part of the coast. So we have vestiges of a really distinct, cooler fauna there. So seeing how all these elements were kind of interdigitating was one of my main interests here. Unfortunately, these mountains picked a very bad place to be. They encircle the LA Basin here, which at last count was something like 16 million people strong and growing. So there's a lot of development pressure up into these mountains. And even aside from development, there's a lot of recreation going on in these mountains. People like to play with very destructive toys like fire and off-road vehicles. And although there's still a remarkable amount of wilderness in this area, it's increasingly impacted by all these outside forces. There are a lot of pollution issues, invasive plant issues, and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of diversity there and a lot of pressure. So we really wanted to get in here and figure out what there is and hopefully try to promote the understanding of diversity in these areas for conservation reasons. And really, there are a lot of agencies that are interested in understanding more about what's here and using that to help protect the area. So that's really a major goal of all that we're doing, both on the diversity side and the genetic side. So this area has attracted a lot of interest in the past from systematists and biogeographers. A study a few years back by Ryan Kalsbeek tried to pull together all of the intraspecific studies that had been done on all kinds of organisms throughout the California Floristic Province, and repeatedly found this break in genetic lineages within species across the transverse ranges. So most groups that he looked at, not all, but the majority were showing very distinct northern and southern groups across the transverse ranges. So clearly there's something going on here. I always felt like this was a very simplistic approach, or at least an inference from this, because it is a very complex range and there's clearly stuff going on within it that pertain to this very, you know, too clean break that he reconstructed. So we wanted to look at this in a lot more detail. And I'm sorry, I'm showing a staphyliniform. I couldn't avoid it. But One of the first species that we worked through phylogeographically was this rove beetle, Cepedophilus castaneus, and we sampled very densely across the transverse ranges and some outlying areas and found some very beautiful phylogeographic structure with regions really coming out quite distinct from one another. And we found this major break between the southeastern transverse ranges, the San Gabriel, San Bernardinos, and San Jacintos over here, from essentially everything to the north, this larger clade. And so separated right between the San Gabriels and this little range in here we call the Sierra Pelona, and even though we had sampling sites that were 30 kilometers apart, there appeared to be no contact across that break. So this was really nice, much more detailed perspective on what might be going on in this area. So this was a great start, and we wanted to continue looking at this with other species. So a couple of tenebrionids have been playing a role in this work. Tenebrionids are actually a very appealing group for phylogeography because so many of them are flightless. You would expect that they're going to show a lot more site specificity and genetic structure. One of these that we've looked at is Nyctoporus carinata. This is a very unusual thing. The genus is an endemic out here. It's kind of a woodland species, but really occurs in a lot of different environments from sea level on up well into the mountains, over 7,000 feet. And epigeic is just a surface active thing. You find it out wandering around on the surface of the soil at night. And I was glad to learn from my Greek-speaking co-author that Nyctoporus means the night walker, which I think is a really nice common name. So I'll probably be referring to them as that from here on. Coelus ciliatus is quite different in habitats. This is a coastal species, just found in sandy soils. There are a few isolated inland populations or potentially endemic species of this thing that seem to have gotten just left behind when seas receded, but they do mainly occur underground. Again, they're both flightless, and there had been some studies of morphological variations showing that there's some geographic pattern even in morphology here, so that was a good signal that they'd be worth looking at. So the methods for this sort of work, this is fairly standard. Dense sampling is really critical to being able to tease apart these area relationships. We sequence just mitochondrial DNA at this point, which is a standard for this sort of work with good reason. We've built trees many, many different ways, and I'm not going to go through all those. And we've been doing a lot of more population genetic statistical analyses as well. I'm not going to get into that here. So for Nyctoporus, we sampled 119 individuals, again, very densely across the transverse ranges and some outlying areas. And this is a large part of the range of this species. There are probably some more populations down here that we didn't get. But as you get further north, you're starting to get into some other, at least nominate, species. And that's true of these Sierran ones here as well, which I'll come back to. So this is a Bayesian tree, and we've got some posterior probabilities on the branches. And this actually shows a very nice picture as well. We have very deep divergences between very well geographically defined clades. And we were blown away by the amount of diversity in this group. So out of our 119 samples, 92 distinct haplotypes. So nearly every individual that we sequenced was different. And probably with enough sequence, you would find that, which doesn't seem possible. But these were as different as 11% from each other, which is really not allowed for single species. We don't really have a good metric for that, but it seems pretty clear that there's more than one thing here, or at least that they're really not in contact with each other from region to region. I'm not going to go into great detail trying to tease apart all these area relationships, but we do see here the Sierran populations are really quite distinct from everything in the coast and transverse ranges, and then our most basal clades here are actually the southernmost, or the northernmost and the southernmost. So they seem to have gotten split apart very early on and then kind of maybe filled in this middle region. You probably noticed this little N. van Dyckei question mark down here. This is that Sierran population that we found up here, which was named by Blaisdell and really is a distinct looking thing. It's a lot narrower and a little bit more refined looking than typical carinata. So at first we thought, okay, well that might actually be something good, but we can see that it's paraphyletic with respect to some Tehachapi real obvious carinata. So it's not that clear cut, and we've definitely still got some work to do on this thing. But it's certainly showing that there is a lot more diversity in this region than we would have guessed. So with Coelus, John Doyen had looked at this thing back in the 70s and early 80s, and did some morphometric work and really showed that there were major discontinuities morphologically along the California coast, appearing to break somewhere near Point Conception, which I'll show you on a map in a minute. But this is essentially the westernmost end of our transverse ranges. So this seemed to maybe correspond to some of the breaks that we're seeing in other things. And it would be very interesting to see if these coastal species were responding to some of the same factors that inland ones were. And we're also interested in looking because there's another species of Coelus with essentially the same overall range that's much more rare. And the state of California has become interested in this. And really, any projects that involve coastal areas are required to look for Coelus globosus now and try to determine what the population status is. So we were hoping that by maybe understanding relationships in Ciliatus, some of that might